As we have pointed out, virtually all Christians, to say nothing about other people, are theologians. That is just to say, however, that they all think or talk about God, or to God, or for God. But more than this, and more significantly, all Christians from time to time are compelled to be theologians. Professor Gerhard Ferdi clearly sets out both the issue and its significance when he writes, "Being a theologian just means thinking and speaking about God." True, we may not do much of that. We might go for days and weeks without a thought of God entering our heads, but that is usually impossible. Things happen. Accidents, tragedies, deaths and funerals, natural disasters, illness, loss, suffering, disappointment, wrongdoing, and so on and on. There is also good fortune, perhaps unexpected success or escape from danger or certain disaster, experience of great beauty or pleasure, sheer grace, chance encounters that determine our lives, love. We begin to wonder. God pops into our thinking and conversation. We may cry out in agony, "Why, God?" or in relief, "Thank God." Or we may just use God's name in cursing. Sooner or later, we are likely to get thinking about God and wondering if there is some logic to it all in our lives or some injustice. We become theologians. Becoming a theologian is not a matter to be taken lightly. We can be blessed by it if we get it right, as well as cursed by it if we don't. Nevertheless, the task, especially for believers, is inescapable. That passage was from his helpful book on being a theologian of the cross, from which I will refer again. Now, what does it mean, as Professor Ferdi said, to get it right? And what does it mean to get it wrong? We can get considerable help and insight into these questions by appropriating Martin Luther's distinction between the theologian of the cross and the theologian of glory, especially as he spelled it out in the Heidelberg Disputation of 1518. You see, you could say that Martin Luther gave us a name and a description for the people who get it right, and correspondingly, a name and a description for the people who get it wrong, namely, the theologian of the cross and the theologian of glory. And you could say that he gave us a name for getting it right, and correspondingly a name for getting it wrong, the theology of the cross and the theology of glory. Now, it might help to be clear about our terms before proceeding. That is because it is common to use the term theology of the cross to refer to a certain doctrine of salvation. That doctrine or teaching would go something like this: God saves by grace alone on account of the atoning sacrifice that Christ made with his death on the cross and his resurrection from the dead. And it is also common to set this account of salvation against what is then called a theology of glory, which usually stands for some doctrine of salvation by human works, and which is criticized for glorifying human creatures and their abilities. We, however, are going to use the terms differently. The distinction between the theology of the cross and the theology of glory that we are dealing with does not refer to two different accounts or two different teachings about Christ, the cross, and salvation. The distinction as we are using it refers to two different ways of operating as theologians, two different ways of talking about God and his relationship to anything and everything in creation. Having said that, I should also say that the distinction does often function as an attack on good works and good intentions, and this is what makes the theology of the cross hard to follow and the theologian of the cross hard to hear. The theology of the cross, as Professor Ferdy says, is an offensive theology. The offense consists in the fact that, unlike other theologies, it attacks what we usually consider the best in our religion. As we will see, theologians of the cross do not worry so much about what is obviously bad in our religion, our bad works, as they do about the pretension that comes with our good works. So the theology of the cross can only be spoken of truthfully in contrast to all other types of theology. To express this, Luther made a fundamental distinction between the theology of the cross and the theology of glory. Well, turning then from Professor Ferdy, let's ask, what about the distinction itself? The distinction that Luther makes in his Heidelberg Disputation goes like this. A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is. This, of course, is admirably clear, but what does this distinction amount to? It is important first to realize that the concern here has to do primarily with how one speaks about God and his works. In other words, with how one is a theologian. This is made clear in the 19th and 20th theses of the Heidelberg Disputation. The one called the theologian of glory, Luther holds, does not deserve to be called a theologian because he looks upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible in those things which have actually happened. Thesis 19. The theologian of the cross, on the other hand, deserves to be called a theologian because he comprehends the visible and manifest things of God through suffering and the cross. But then, what does looking upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible amount to? And what does comprehending the visible and manifest things of God through suffering and the cross amount to? Here we must pay especially close attention, not because the matters become complex or abstract, but because claiming to see into the invisible things of God is often among our very best works, so we think. And so the distinction between being a theologian of the cross and being a theologian of glory attacks them and us who do them. The invisible things of God that Luther has in mind are such attributes as virtue, godliness, wisdom, justice, goodness, and so forth. The theologian of glory, then, would be the person who claims to understand or to perceive God's wisdom or justice or goodness in some thing or some event or some situation in which these things are invisible, in which they are not evident. By doing this, however, he ends up calling evil good and good evil. For instance, this is what Job's so-called friends do. Job is suffering. Why? He is a righteous man, but he suffers. Would God do this? No, so his friends think. God is just. So something is wrong with the picture. And it has to be that God is being just and that Job is not really as righteous as they all think. And so his friends urge him to confess. Or to take another biblical instance, consider how the prophet Habakkuk perceives God's justice when he complains about having to look at injustice. And consider how the prophet perceives God's virtue when he dares to presume that God's eyes are too pure to look on evil, and that he cannot tolerate wrong. Such persons do not deserve to be called theologians. And indeed, Job's friends provoke God's wrath, and Habakkuk provoked the Lord to raise up the Babylonians and to denounce him and all like him as puffed up and unjust. The theologian of the cross, by contrast, is one who acknowledges God's presence and work in all events and circumstances. even difficult, painful, evil ones. When one does this, the theologian calls the thing what it actually is, instead of explaining it away in the name of God's justice or God's love or something else they know about God. For instance, Job himself acknowledges God and his work rightly after his children are killed, saying, "The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And when he responds to his wife's advice, "Curse God and die," by saying, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" In the end, Habakkuk also speaks rightly about God, seeing him present and active in calamity just as much as in deliverance. Finally, we should ask what makes calling a thing what it actually is so difficult. At the heart of the issue is the question about God and his works. Stanley Fish, a noted scholar of John Milton, has said that the hardest thing to get across to students about Paradise Lost is that God is God. That is the central issue when it comes to being theologians. To see this, let's look at Thesis 4 of the Heidelberg Disputation, which speaks about God and his works. Luther said, "Although the works of God are always unattractive and appear evil, they are nevertheless really eternal merits." The works that Luther is talking about are the works of salvation. What's so unattractive about that? It's not salvation as much as the way that God saves. God saves by first damning. God heals by first wounding. God builds up by first crushing. God makes alive by first killing. Damning, wounding, crushing, killing, these are ways of referring to what is often called the alien work of God, God's strange work. Saving, healing, building up, making alive, these are ways of referring to what is usually called the proper work of God. How does this alien or strange work get done? It can be done by calling a thing what it actually is. It is done, for instance, when we say that, yes, to say that justification is by grace alone means that we have to let God justify us. It is simply pointless to try to justify oneself before God. This means that we have to wait for and depend on God's word. This means that our own works and our own intentions count for absolutely nothing. And that hurts. That distresses. That doesn't seem fair. But that is how things actually are. And the theologian of the cross says what a thing actually is. In this way, then, the truth about God can be very threatening. The truth about God can and will threaten our self-assurance, our self-confidence, our self-righteousness. The theologian of the cross, who speaks the truth then, can be the agent of God's alien, threatening work. And that can be difficult. And yet this can turn out to be a very good thing. As Luther so clearly saw, it turns out that it is precisely by being a threat that God gets an opportunity to be heard by sinners who otherwise would rather do without him. It is precisely by being a threat that God cannot be ignored, by making sinners passive, that his promises have a chance to be spoken and to be believed. The works of God always appear unattractive and evil, for they leave sinners no room to operate. They show us that our works are of no avail, and neither are our good intentions. Everything is in God's hands, and the theologian of the cross will bring this out. And yet it is just in this experience, in this passion, which Christ himself experienced, Christ who said, my God, why have you forsaken me? It is in this experience that there is room for God actually to do something, namely, to speak his forgiveness and his promises of life and salvation. And where and when it pleases God, he gives his Spirit to create faith in the absolution and in his promises. And the works of God, which seem so unattractive and evil-looking, bring about salvation.